Welcome back, dear listeners. You are listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. Today we are discussing what not to do in a situation where you want to hit your child or you feel that you are forced to do so, and how to deal with such a situation if you really think that you are forced to hit your child. There are some regulations, some limits you should at least try to follow. Dear Sayyid, please enlighten us further.
So these are a few things that we need to consider when it comes to hitting children. And obviously, if we keep these things in mind, then no one's going to hit his child, at least. And if they do,
right,
it wouldn't be much of hitting if this point kept in mind.
Right.
And especially sometimes when these things happen, which I think we might touched upon last night, or last episode, is that when you have two siblings and they get into a fight and that you want to discipline one and not the other.
Yeah.
So there are also a few things that you need to keep in mind to keep the justice, at least in terms of punishment with kids. You can't just punish one and leave the other. That will cause a lot of problems. So if you see two kids, for example, and both of the siblings are fighting, you can't just, hit one and leave the other one. So if they need to punish, both of them have to be punished. At least they would feel the other one does
There's
not feel
justice.
Neglected.
He
feels
right.
A bit of justice,
yeah.
Okay? So, yeah, I got hit, she got hit, we're good. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
If I get hit and she doesn't get hit, even I know that she had some of, you know, as a child, I know that she had a part of this issue,
right?
But she got away with it. I'm gonna feel not only I feel that upset that I got hit, but I also feel upset that she got away with it.
It becomes a whole drama, say,
yeah,
like
so
he's the oppressed one now, and she's the one who got spoiled, and this starts
so
a whole other episode.
I'm speaking from a child's mentality,
right? Yeah.
So we should not, as parents, if you need to punish, make sure you punish both of them, not one of them.
Right.
I'm not saying like hit them both, but at least if you want to do any sort of punishment, it has to be done on one of them to have that that justice happening between the kids.
Right.
And also you have to make sure that if you want to punish children, you have to make sure that you don't punish an innocent child as well in the process. Because sometimes people get angry at one child, and then all of a sudden the other one get bashed as well for no apparent
Everybody
reason.
In the vicinity. Like
yeah,
if you
yes.
even just look at the angry parent or just breathe in a way, you get it too. Rest assured,
yeah,
unfortunately.
So I've seen parents when they get angry, like, you know, one child does something stupid and the other child had nothing to do with it, also get hit. For example, a parent walks in the house and one is making him angry, the one next to him also copped something. Or sometimes when they want to punish an innocent child, for example, one of them done something wrong, so the father says, no one is watching TV. He's
right.
trying to punish one child, but in the process he punished everyone else.
It's the same thing in school, if you remember, in the classroom, if somebody threw something or
yeah,
didn't
so
do their
the
homework, everybody gets punished. How is this justice?
Exactly. That's not
horrible
justice.
Feeling.
That makes you hate the teacher, makes you hate everything.
Exactly,
so,
yeah.
So we have to make sure that if we punish a child, we don't punish a child as innocent, and that we do not include everybody in that punishment. It has to be done fairly and justly.
And inshallah, keeping that in mind, we will have to end today's program because we are out of time. I thank the dear Sayyid for his insightful knowledge, and I also thank the dear listeners for tuning in. If our dear listeners have any questions or comments or some feedback, please contact us at our email, englishradio@irib.ir. You can also visit our website, parstoday.com. Alternatively, if you're not such a big fan of these two methods, old-fashioned methods, you can also find us on the various social media sites, such as on Twitter and Instagram, under the call handle of Call of Islam Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest. A way of life, a way of life, a way of life, a way of life. Islam is a way of life.
The very first revolution that started with the people, continued with the people, did not change its word, did not change its way, did not decrease or increase its goals, is the Islamic Revolution of Iran. Ayatollah Khamenei.
جانم تپشم سخنم باشد وطنم وطنم ای خان که گوهر خیز بهره وطنم قدمم عشقم سخنم قسمم از عاشقی لبریز.
Congratulations on the victory anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. In the limelight.
It can't be emphasized enough just how many taxpayer dollars are now being showered on the Pentagon, says William Harting, journalist, in an article titled $778 billion and counting. Who is paying for all this Pentagon waste? Stay tuned for the second part of this article, please. Unbelievably enough, the U.S. covered the globe military strategy, including a planet-wide footprint of more than 750 military bases, more than 200,000 troops stationed overseas, huge and costly aircraft carrier task forces eternally floating the seven seas, and a massive nuclear arsenal that could destroy life as we know it, with thousands of warheads to spare. You only need to look at the human and economic costs of America's post-9/11 wars to grasp the utter folly of such a strategy. According to Brown University's Cost of War project, the conflicts waged by the United States in this century have cost $8 trillion and counting, with hundreds of thousands of civilian casualties, thousands of U.S. troops killed, and hundreds of thousands more suffering from traumatic brain injuries and post-traumatic stress disorder. And for what? In Iraq, the U.S. cleared the way for a sectarian regime that then helped create the conditions for Daesh to sweep in and conquer significant parts of the country, only to be repelled but not thoroughly defeated at a great cost in lives and treasure. Meanwhile, in Afghanistan, after conflict doomed as soon as it morphed into an exercise in nation-building and larger-scale counterinsurgency, the Taliban is now in power. It's hard to imagine a more ringing indictment of the policy of endless war. Despite the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan, spending on global counter-terror operations remains at high levels. Thanks to ongoing missions by special operations forces, repeated air strikes, ongoing military aid and training, and other kinds of involvement short of full-scale war. Given the opportunity to rethink a strategy as part of a global force posture, review released late last year, the Biden administration opted for a remarkably status quo approach, insisting on maintaining substantial bases in the West Asia-North Africa region, while modestly boosting the U.S. troop presence in East Asia. Despite the immediate headlines about spending on sending troops and planes to Eastern Europe and weapons to Ukraine in response to Russia's massing of its forces on that country's borders, the dominant narrative for keeping the Pentagon budget at its current size remains China. It matters little that the greatest challenges posed by America are political, economic, and military. The National Defense Strategy Commission, a congressionally mandated body charged with critiquing the Pentagon's official strategy document, drew more than half its members from individuals on the boards of arms-making corporations, working as consultants for the arms industry or from think tank heavily funded by just such contractors. Not surprisingly, the commission called for a 3% to 5% annual increase in a Pentagon budget into foreseeable future. Follow that blueprint and you are talking $1 trillion annually by the middle of this decade, according to an analysis by Taxpayers for Common Sense. Such an increase, in other words, would prove sustainable in a country where so much else is needed, but that won't stop Pentagon budget hawks from using it as their North Star. In March of this year, the Pentagon expected to release both its National Defense Strategy and its budget for 2023. There are a few small glimmers of hope, like reports that the administration may abandon certain dangerous and unnecessary nuclear weapons program instituted by the Trump administration. However, the true challenge crafting a budget that addresses genuine security problems like public health and the climate crisis would require fresh thinking and persistent public pressure to slash the Pentagon budget while reducing the size of the military-industrial complex. Without a significant change, of course, 2022 will once again be a banner year for Lockheed Martin and other top weapons makers at the expense of investing in programs necessary to combat urgent challenges from pandemics to climate change to global inequality.
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except Him, and He has enjoined kindness to parents.
For humanity.
Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan al-la'in ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Brothers and sisters, dear listeners, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatihi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We are looking at Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali ibn Abi Talib, the commander of the faithful, and his perspective on human rights. Before Amir al-Mu'mineen attained rulership, or khilafah as they call it, it was likely that the Umayyad government might be converted into a kingship. Rather, it had already been so converted, because we know what Muawiyah did, and he made his son Yazid a king, and he became a king himself and then became a kingdom. The rulers and other people at the helm of affairs were of the view that the Khilafah was their special right, and only they were entitled to it on account of their belonging to the noble family. In order to strengthen their hold and establish a firm government by considering all unlawful acts like tribes, like tribal biases, formation of groups, bribes, etc., to be lawful, according to them, a ruler was the master of the lives, property, and honor of the ruled, and could, obviously, and could exploit them in any manner they like, without the oppressed people having the right to protest. And sadly, they viewed the common people as a quadruped who they could load in the heaviest burden and beat as much as they wish. Well, obviously, that's what they did. During the time of the Umayyad, of Uthman and the Umayyad government, so the demise of Uthman and the beginning of the Umayyad government, the Umayyad governor got an opportunity to do despotic rule, and they availed it to their heart and told their hearts were content. They endeavored to strengthen their Umayyad rule in all parts of the Islamic territories. They bribed the sheikhs and dignitaries and of the Arab tribes heavily to win their support. So the Umayyad dynasty, because Uthman, he himself, has given them too much power, they were trying to buy tribes and the tribe leaders to strengthen the Umayyad rule. And obviously they were doing that just so they could become rulers, so they can rule the life of other people. So they also bought arms forces by giving them excessive wealth and promising them high offices. And in fact, the people could not oppose them, because whoever did was beheaded or killed. So they were using that by power. Now, power itself, it was meant to be a service for people. When Ali alayhi salam, the commander of the faithful, attained the Khilafah, the conditions were very precise. The people were divided into two groups. The persons belonging to one of those groups were prepared to lay down their lives in support of the pious and just Imam. The other group supported Bani Umayyah and endeavored to strengthen their government and kingdom. Bani Umayyah obviously had also been endeavoring for years to establish their rule since the time of the Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam. However, with Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, he was not there to increase his own popularity, nor was he seeking power, nor did he want to become a king. He was an imam appointed by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, whether they elect him or not. But his aim was to help and serve the people. Bani Umayyah's point and their aim was to rule and become unfair and unjust to people, which is a quite different than that of Amir al-Mu'mineen's view. Let's take a break and then we continue right after.
Dear listeners, you are listening to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You can send us your emails, comments, and questions at englishradio@irib.ir.
Welcome back, brothers and sisters, and you are listening to the program For Humanity. We said Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi, when he attained power, he lived in a very divided society, that a group which supports Bani Umayyah and a group which support him. Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullahi alayhi, he could not sit and tolerate that people should be oppressed. And he sits in his house when the poor citizens and the poor Muslims were being subjected to oppression by Muawiyah and the likes. A brave and steadfast person like Ali alayhi salam could not let the Muslims fall a prey to the atrocities and the wolves of Bani Umayyah and remain silent, because Muawiyah, from time to time, he used to take his army and attack the nearby cities and villages in Iraq, which are close to Syria. And some of these cities, they didn't even have Muslims, they had some Christians. And when the news used to get to Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam, he used to be very upset. So the Imam saw it as a duty upon him to go fight Muawiyah. So when he went to Safin to fight Muawiyah, it wasn't a fight or a battle for wealth or rulership or who is the Khalifa. It was simply a fight for the right of people, for the right of society, for justice, for equality, for fairness, and so on and so forth. So Amir al-Mu'mineen salamullah alayhi had to come forward. If he had not come
to the rescue of the Muslims at that moment, he would have been treated to be a coward and not the brave and valiant person as known throughout history. It is his bravery that made him known through history for standing for truth and justice. Not the muscles, not the sword. It's the will behind the sword. They said that Harun al-Rashid one day was looking for the sword of Amir al-Mu'mineen, and they went across all the land and they could not find it. A person came to him, he said to him, "Why do you want the sword of Amir al-Mu'mineen?" Harun al-Rashid said to him, "Well, that sword that killed the brave men, the bravest of the Arabs were killed by the sword. I want to hold it." And a man said to him, "Listen, it is not the sword. It is the hand behind the sword. It is the will of Ali alayhi salam to stand up for justice, to stand up for the right of man, to stand up for equality and equality and quantity of people, equity and equality of people, not just the sword itself. It's not a skill of fighting. In fact, it's the skill of standing for those who are weak and those who do not have anyone to support them." He himself said, "I was worried and alarmed lest the foolish and wicked person should come to the rule of this nation and make the property of God their own plaything and the creatures of God their own slaves, and fight with the righteous and make the tyrants their helpers." He himself said these words, "I am alarmed. I don't want them to turn the servants of Allah, the creatures of Allah, into servants and their property into their plaything, where they just have fun with it." And if you read history, this is exactly what Bani Umayyah did. They turned people into slaves to the extent Yazid, may Allah curse him, when he became a ruler, he went to Medina, he looted the city of Medina, they committed heinous crimes. They killed hundreds and thousands of people. They raped hundreds and thousands of women. And then Yazid made them swear an oath that they are nothing but his servants. This is not something Ali alayhi salam would stand for. Thank you for listening. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa alihi. اللهم صل على محمد وآله.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks, amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a U.S. ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the U.S. continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
the U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there. Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 that started, you know, was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. You know, in Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters, that, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli, that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, short answer to this is it's called misdirection, or projection as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate the pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded. China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after U.S. President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that they're reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon, but the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Israel is widely viewed as a destabilizing force in the West Asia region. It has started many wars over the past decades against regional nations. The occupying regime's hostile actions are unending. Right now, it is enforcing its expansionist policies in occupied Palestinian territories by building on lands that the international community insists must be given back to the Palestinians. The regime has gained notoriety for committing crimes of apartheid against the Palestinian people on a very large scale. Parts of Syrian and Lebanese territories are also occupied by Israel. The regime routinely carries out airstrikes against Syrian army positions. Among other destabilizing Israeli actions in the region are high-profile assassinations of top nuclear scientists in Iran and sabotage operations against Iranian nuclear energy facilities. The list of Israel's destabilizing activities and crimes seem endless. Despite the regime's record, some regional states have been getting close to it. The United Arab Emirates seems to be leading the way. The UAE normalized ties with Israel in September 2020 as part of a U.S.-backed initiative that also includes Bahrain, Sudan, and Morocco. Days ago, Israeli President Isaac Herzog made his first visit to the UAE more than a month after Naftali Bennett became the first Israeli prime minister to visit the country. The president of the regime, widely blamed for regional insecurity in the most volatile part of the world, said ironically that Israel supports the Emirates' security needs.
So it's like bringing the fox in to protect the chicken house. That's not going to work. You let them in, they take over. If you want a good example, look at what happened to the Catholic Church when they signed an agreement with Israel. Israel got everything it wanted, and they never fulfilled one of the obligations that they said they would fulfill. And the situation for Christians in Israel is worse now than before they signed that agreement.
During his visit to the UAE, Herzog discussed security and bilateral ties with Abu Dhabi Crown Prince Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan. Sheikh Mohammed said Israel and the UAE share a, quote, common view of the threats to regional stability and peace. Israel is notorious for creating insecurity in the West Asia region. Why are some Arab countries getting close to the regime and claim they want to enhance security? A few days after Herzog's visit, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian issued a stark warning about the Israeli regime's presence in the region. In a phone call with Emirati Minister of Foreign Affairs and International Cooperation, Sheikh Abdullah bin Zayed Al Nahyan, Amir Abdullahian described Israel as a quote-unquote threat to all regional countries, urging efforts to prevent those who create tensions from gaining a foothold there. What would be the consequence of the Israeli regime gaining a stronger foothold in the region? Palestinian resistance group Hamas has also reacted to Herzog's visit. It said such visits encouraged the occupation to continue escalating its aggression against the Palestinian people and denial of their rights. The Palestinians, who already face an uphill battle against the occupation, have described the normalization as a stab in the back. The equation in the region has become increasingly complex, keeping observers guessing how it will evolve.
For centuries, Iran was governed by monarchies and autocratic rulers, and the last dynasty to rule was founded by Reza Shah Pahlavi in 1925. During his reign that lasted for 16 years, Reza Shah replaced Islamic laws with Western ones as part of reforms that drew public discontent. In 1941, he was forced to abdicate the throne to his son, Mohammad Reza. The new Shah maintained a close relationship with the U.S. His government was known for its autocracy and focus on westernization, as well as a disregard for religious and democratic measures in Iran's constitution. Mohammad Reza Shah was largely criticized for political corruption and the oppression committed by his secret police, known as Savak. He established the service with help from Israel and the CIA, its main aim to monitor opponents and repress dissent. Savak's practice of torture and executions of the regime's opponents made it the most notorious and feared institution in Iran prior to the Islamic Revolution. In 1963, the Shah launched a series of reforms known as the White Revolution. Although the reforms brought some progress to Iran, they were met with a strong criticism from the public. The opposition to Shah and his White Revolution was spearheaded by Ayatollah Khomeini, a prominent religious figure who believed the Shah had embarked on a path toward the destruction of Islam. In June of that year, Imam Khomeini delivered his famous sermon at Fazia Seminary, where he strongly criticized the Shah's policies. After that speech, he was arrested, and that sparked 3 days of mass rallies nationwide, with his supporters saying 15,000 people were killed by police. After spending 8 months under house arrest, Imam Khomeini was released. but he remained a strong and outspoken critic of the Shah regime for its policies, including its close cooperation with Israel. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile for another 15 years, but popular support for him grew even further during his absence. Opposition to the Pahlavi regime continued to spread, with Iranians outraged at a high inflation rate, a widening gap between rich and poor, and the repression of freedom of speech. Anger was also high at the royal family benefiting the most from the country's oil revenues at a time when thousands of poor people were suffering under austerity measures to curb the inflation. Popular rage was further ignited by the death of Imam Khomeini's son Mustafa at the hands of Savak. His death on October 23, 1977, set off a chain of mass demonstrations that grew in the months ahead and turned into a campaign of civil resistance. To appease the protesters, the Shah regime launched reforms and pledged to do more. However, none of those measures were welcome, with the protesters remaining steadfast as insisting that the monarchy must be overthrown and that Imam Khomeini should return home. The anti-Shah demonstrations started growing in their millions nationwide, despite a heavy-handed crackdown by the military. On January 16, 1979, the Shah and his family finally left Iran for Egypt. And nearly 2 weeks later, on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned to Tehran with a promise to form a government that would have popular support. On February the 11th, the Pahlavi regime was overthrown and the Islamic Revolution emerged victorious. And on April the 1st, Iran became an Islamic Republic in a referendum voted for by more than 98% of the electorate. The period from February the 1st to 11th is known as Dahe Fajr, or the 10-day dawn in Iran. Every year, Iranians celebrate the Islamic Revolution that brought an end to 2,500 years of monarchical rule in their country.
A spiritual leader who maintained a simple lifestyle. Ayatollah Sayyid Ruhollah Mousavi Khomeini was born in the city of Khomein on September 24, 1902. He grew up in a family with a long tradition of religious scholarship. He received early Quranic education at home and local schools, and pursued his later studies at Islamic seminaries until he became marja, or a source of emulation, a highly prominent authority in religious law. Imam Khomeini soon rose to fame as an anti-imperialism and anti-colonialism icon. He became politically active when, in 1963, the then US-backed monarch of Iran, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, launched a program of reforms known as the White Revolution. The plan was an American-inspired package of measures designed to prop up the regime and nip any voices of dissent in the bud, all in the name of promoting the rights of citizens. Imam Khomeini was the first religious leader who openly condemned the Shah's program of westernization. That opposition led to protests against the monarch. In response, the Pahlavi regime launched a brutal crackdown and arrested Imam Khomeini. His detention resulted in an uprising in June 1963. Demonstrators were confronted by tanks and troops armed to the teeth. Thousands were killed. In November 1964, Imam Khomeini was rearrested and sent into exile, this time because he had opposed the legal immunity the Shah had granted to American military personnel in Iran. He spent over 14 years in exile, mostly in the holy city of Najaf in Iran. But that didn't stop him from criticizing the Shah for making concessions to Western powers, in his view, a violation of Iranian sovereignty. People from all walks of life listened to his speeches via cassettes and distributed his letters, which became the bedrock of a budding revolution. In the early 1970s, Imam Khomeini gave a series of lectures in Najaf on the establishment of a system based on Islamic values. Those lectures were later published as a book under the title Guardianship of the Islamic Jurists. This was his most famous and influential work. It laid out his ideas on a system of governance that would end dictatorship, establish Sharia, or Islam's divine law, and would fight injustice, corruption, and oppression. Imam Khomeini's courage, charisma, and popularity opened a new chapter in a grassroots resistance against the Pahlavi regime.
Mad Bashar, Mad Bashar, Mad Bashar.
ultimately, on the 16th of January, 1979, the Shah fled Iran, and on February the 1st, Imam Khomeini returned from Nofello Chateau in France, where he'd been living in exile. 10 days later, Iranians celebrated as their revolution culminated in the overthrow of the US-backed Pahlavi regime. In March 1979, more than 98% of Iranians voted in favor of an Islamic Republic in a referendum. Under such a system proposed by Imam Khomeini, Iran is considered a sovereign country in the form of a republic that implements Islamic laws. A system in marked contrast to the dictatorial Pahlavi regime that was totally dependent on the West, in particular the United States.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Anti-war advocates have recently accused the Biden administration of continued warmongering after President Joe Biden confirmed he plans to send U.S. troops to Eastern Europe. Please stay with us for an article in this regard written by Julia Conley, journalist. This article is published under the heading Anti-war groups pan Biden for announcing troop deployment to Eastern Europe. Stay tuned for the details of this article, please. Anti-war advocates have recently accused the Biden administration of continued warmongering after President Joe Biden confirmed he plans to send U.S. troops to Eastern Europe. Biden told reporters at Joint Base Andrews recently, "I will be moving troops to Eastern Europe in the NATO countries in the near term. Not too many." Earlier this week, the president announced that 8,500 troops were standing ready for a potential deployment to confront what the White House claims is an imminent attack by Russian forces in Ukraine, despite pleas by Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop creating panic. In a recent phone call, Zelensky reportedly questioned the Biden administration's belief and claim promoted by the corporate media that a Russian invasion is imminent. "I am the president of Ukraine. I am based here, and I think I know the details deeper than any other president," Zelensky told the press after the call, adding, "The image that mass media creates is that we have troops on the roads, we have mobilization, people are leaving for places. That's not the case. We don't need this panic." Veteran journalist John Pilger tweeted that Zelensky's comments exposed the warmongering of Biden as a crime. As Common Dreams reported recently, U.S. War Secretary Lloyd Austin expressed hope that the diplomatic approach could avoid conflict with Russia, which has demanded a guarantee that Ukraine will be excluded from NATO along with other security measures. Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Mark Milley also spoke recently and called on Russian President Vladimir Putin to pursue diplomacy after Putin reportedly spoke to French President Emmanuel Macron about implementing a diplomatic agreement forged in 2014. Milley warned that there will be horrific consequences if Russia invades Ukraine. Given the type of forces that are arrayed, the ground maneuver forces, the artillery, the ballistic missiles, the air forces, all of it packaged together, if that was unleashed on Ukraine, it would be significant, very significant, and it would result in a significant amount of casualties, he told reporters. Peace group Code Pink accused the Biden administration of reaching, putting the entire world at risk. While the U.S. public and international leaders make clear their anti-war stance, Russia doesn't want war. Ukraine doesn't want war. The American people don't want war, tweeted the group, adding, "The Biden administration needs to get with the program and stop endangering us all."
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I am your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be looking at a very important question, and that is a question that is often brought up by non-Muslims and as an objection towards Islam, and that is the question about, is Islam a violent religion or not? This question, you know, it leads to a second question, and that is that if somebody answers in the positive, right, people will say, well, a religion shouldn't be violent. Religion should be peaceful, right? If it wants to, if we want to, you know, religion, the purpose of religion is to bring people closer to God, and we can become closer to God, you know, in such turbulence by being violent, right? Rather, we have to be closer to God. We have to sit in the corner of our house or church or the temple and contemplate God and think about Him and try to achieve some sort of peace with Him. And how could one do that when one is, for example, fighting jihad against somebody else or in a battle? I'd like to answer this question by referencing a tradition and a hadith regarding one of the battles in which Imam Ali was present in. In one of the battles in which Imam Ali participated in, following the demise of the Prophet, in the thick of the battle, in the very heat of the battle, Imam Ali paused for a moment. He came to his tent and he rested. He's surrounded by his companions. In this time, a Bedouin came to Imam Ali and asked Imam Ali a question, a theological question regarding God and predestination. He asked Imam Ali, are we here because in this battle, are we fighting here in this battle because we have been predestined to or not? Now, when this Bedouin asked Imam Ali alayhi salam this question, the companions of Imam Ali who were surrounding him, they became upset and said, can't you see that the Imam, the commander of the faithful, is preoccupied with much more important things right now than what you are asking him about? When Imam Ali heard his companions scold the Bedouin in this way, the Imam became quite upset and said, let him ask his question. Because, and this is very important, he said, the whole reason why we are here in this battle and fighting with the people we are fighting is because of this very purpose, right? It's because of this very purpose. In other words, if we're fighting these people, if we are in this battle and we're waging this war against these uncouths and these criminals, it is because we want people to become closer to God. We want them to achieve this proximity to God, achieve this knowledge and this awareness and this cognition of these matters that this Bedouin is asking us about. This shows us that, right, it is this hadith is very beautiful in the sense that not only does it show us that it's possible, even in these such situations, where in such violent situations, to still achieve this proximity to God, but actually the whole purpose of this and the function of this of jihad and war and battle in Islam is this proximity that we want to achieve to God. Thank you for joining us here today on The Key. We were examining Islam and violence. Until next time, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.
In the limelight.
Sanctions currently imposed on Afghanistan are on track to take the lives of more civilians in the coming year than have been killed by 20 years of warfare. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Mark Weisbrot, writer. This article is published under the heading, U.S. Sanctions on Afghanistan Could Be Deadlier Than 20 Years of War. Stay tuned for more. Economic sanctions have in recent years become one of the most important tools of U.S. foreign policy. There are currently more than 20 countries subjected to various sanctions from the U.S. government. But if more Americans knew how many innocent civilians actually die as a result of these sanctions, would the worst of them be permitted? Sanctions currently imposed on Afghanistan are on track to take the lives of more civilians in the coming year than have been killed by 20 years of warfare. There is no hiding it anymore. Projections through the winter estimate that 22.8 million people will face high levels of acute food insecurity. This is 55% of Afghanistan population, the highest ever recorded in the country. An estimated 1 million children are suffering from severe acute malnutrition this year in Afghanistan. Children who are malnourished are more likely to die from other diseases, even when they can't get enough calories and nutrients to survive. Already, 98% of the population is not getting enough food, according to the UN World Food Program. The biggest and most destructive sanction currently facing Afghanistan is the seizure of more than $7 billion of the country's assets that are held at the U.S. Federal Reserve. This is equivalent to about 40% of Afghanistan's economy and about 14 months of the country's imports, which include food, medicine, and infrastructure needs that are vital to public health. But the impact of this loss of central bank assets turns out to be much deadlier than the loss of essential imports. The assets confiscated are in dollars. Countries need these hard currency international reserves in order to maintain a stable financial system and economy. Since the freezing of the country's reserves, cash shortages and the loss of correspondent banking relationships have crippled Afghan banks, reports the International Monetary Fund, IMF. Press reports from the ground describe calamitous human costs of the disruption that results when these reserves are lost. Desperate mothers seeking medicine for emaciated children, soaring numbers of people going without income, farmers giving up on working their land. In the first 4 months following the sanctions, Afghanistan's currency depreciated by 30%, driving the price of food and other essentials beyond the reach of many people in what was already the poorest country in Asia. Banks imposed a $400 limit on cash withdrawals and also restrictions that make businesses unable to meet their payrolls. This pushes more people into unemployment and acute hunger. Supporters of sanctions in the U.S. government and elsewhere have responded that people who are starving, malnourished, or unemployed as a result of sanctions can be helped with international aid. However, it is clear that the logic of destroying an economy and then trying to save people with aid does not work. Aid will replace only a very small fraction of the country's loss of income, which the IMF estimates could fall by an astounding, unprecedented 30% in the month ahead. And there are enormous difficulties in delivering the aid. The banking system is hobbled. International banks and even some aid groups are reluctant to take the risks involved in transferring funds, and there are breakdowns in transport, as well as other essential services because of the sanctions and resultant economic construction. Western governments, led by the U.S., as during 20 years of war, are not likely to get any concessions from the Taliban by destroying the Afghan economy. But an enormous price will be paid by millions of innocent people, many of whom will die as food, healthcare, employment, and income become increasingly scarce. Members of the U.S. Congress are starting to push back. Ford doesn't send a letter to Biden in December noting the U.S. confiscation of $9.4 billion in Afghanistan's currency reserves is plunging the country deeper into economic and humanitarian crisis. This collective punishment